The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always. The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers.
Hey, everybody, mark your calendars for November 7th. Join colleagues and presenters from AAP Colorado, Idaho, and Utah for our first ever regional CME. This virtual event will be interactive, case-based, and an engaging educational experience with a focus on current issues and hot topics of interest for pediatric professionals. Alisa, where could we go to find out more about this and to sign up?
Yeah, it's going to be a really fantastic event. Our speakers are dynamic. It's going to be great. You can find a link to register on aaputah.org under events under Fall Regional Conference. The registration link is there. Everyone is welcome. You don't have to be a member of the Utah, Idaho, or Colorado chapter to join us. It's open to everybody, and it's going to be a great, great day. So join us on November 7th.
And now this is going to be an interactive event, so it's in real time, right? Starts at 8:30, is that right?
That's right. Starts at 8:30. It's going to kind of follow some of the format that we do here on the podcast. So there'll be some presentation pieces, and then you will be having a conversation, kind of like the podcast, for another portion of the presentation. So you'll have a chance to send in your questions, friends, and ask questions. So it's going to be kind of like if we were in person.
How many hours of CME credit can you get if you attend this?
It will be 6 hours.
Okay. All right. But it'll be the coolest thing that you can do on November 7th.
Right.
All right. We'll look forward to seeing everyone there. Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. We're very fortunate that our trio of guests stuck around to survive another week. We'd like to welcome back to the podcast Nun Tran from the Department of Pediatric Cardiology, Beth Vukin, hospitalist extraordinaire from Primary Children's Hospital, and Aaron Tamarki from the Department of Pediatric Rheumatology. Now, it's well known to anyone who has anything to do with this process that I can never remember to ask about disclosures, and so usually splice something in at the end. But I am going to defy all expectations this week and probably do it right now. Dr. Tran, is there anything that you would like to disclose?
I have no disclosures.
Are there any shout outs that you want to give or any beefs that you have with anyone that you'd like to make more public?
Not that I'm willing to say right now.
Terrific. If you're feeling it by the end, feel free to just let loose. Dr. Vukin, any disclosures?
I don't have any disclosures.
Or Dr. Tamarki, have you developed any conflicts since the last time we talked?
No new conflicts.
All right. Well, work on that because that makes your life richer. Dr. Tran, let's talk a little bit about you. Where are you from originally?
I grew up in Connecticut, and then I did my undergraduate schooling in New Hampshire, and then medical school in Connecticut again, residency in Connecticut, then came out to Utah for cardiology fellowship.
Wonderful. And do you have any particular specialty in cardiology?
So I'm an echocardiographer. But I'm also the medical director of our Kawasaki disease clinic.
Oh, terrific. And so this was also a natural fit for you in coming up with this protocol.
Yes.
So, now, given that you're from Connecticut and Dr. Tamarki is from New York, did you know each other before you came here?
This is a big area.
Just kidding. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about how cardiology fits into this. And one of the things that I was hoping to do is to give us a little bit of a review of some of the things that are important for us to know about the heart in terms of fitting this all in. Hearts are complicated. We think of them as, well, those of us, you don't, but those of us out here sometimes think of hearts as just pumps that, you know, pump your whole life until they don't. But they're also fairly complicated in that there are several parts of them that react differently, and there are several parts that can become inflamed, right?
Correct. Yes.
So just running through my list, you can get pericarditis, you can get myocarditis, you can get endocarditis, you can get valvitis, and you can get coronary artery inflammation. Am I missing something?
I think you about covered it right there.
So what things should make me, because it's not something we think of, but it's important to not miss, what sorts of things should make me think that somebody may have heart inflammation?
So heart inflammation can be fairly difficult to diagnose just by exam, because you can have a variety of symptoms, and depending on the severity of what the degree of inflammation is. So when we see, before COVID, when we see kids with myopericarditis, so often have significant chest pain, and chest pain, as you know, is a pretty common symptom that kids present with frequently. But oftentimes the chest pain that we see in myopericarditis tends to be significant enough where they're often in tears or coming in needing to go to the emergency department due to their severity. And in the setting of decreased function, which is significant inflammation of the heart with the myocarditis, on exam you might have something like a gallop, edema from just RV failure, cough from pulmonary edema, increased work of breathing. So the symptoms can be broad and somewhat nonspecific to diagnose cardiac inflammation.
And what are the more common etiologies of cardiac inflammation in children?
Yeah, so myocarditis can be caused by a variety of things, mostly viruses, things like enteroviruses, most commonly parvovirus as well, sometimes can lead to that, but a variety and influenza. So various viruses can do that. Kawasaki disease can cause a myocarditis, or actually valvulitis and essentially pancarditis, if you will. Rheumatic fever is sort of one of the sort of classic diseases that we think of that leads to a pancarditis as well. So various things.
So you mentioned that on physical exam, something that might indicate that the pump is not functioning properly, or something that we listen to that sounds like inflammation is happening, or that sounds like a part of the heart is not functioning in the way that it usually does. So a new murmur or something like that may be helpful. How about in the lab? Is there anything in the lab that's helpful?
Yeah, so one of the markers of myocardial inflammation is troponin. And so if you have elevated troponins, that suggests myocardial damage. Whether that's ischemia, inflammation, that's one of our hallmarks in terms of labs. Other things from a lab standpoint, something that's used in MISC is an elevation of B natriuretic peptide, which is more a marker of atrial stretch. But depending on fluid shifts, et cetera, if you have a heart that's not pumping well, your atria becomes stretched and can have elevations of your BNP.
And are those both things that are used in the setting of very ill patients, troponin and BNP?
Yeah, so often can be in very ill patients. Sometimes when kids present to the emergency department with chest pain, a troponin is checked and it's elevated, which leads to a call to cardiology. And so even though the child himself or herself is not very sick, it can depend on how much those values are elevated or not.
As you mentioned before, chest pain is a not at all uncommon complaint in the clinic. And when somebody comes in, are there any of those tests that are slam dunk? This is either something that needs a cardiologist or doesn't need a cardiologist?
Yeah, so usually when kids present with chest pain, one of the first things, you know, after the physical exam, say in the emergency department, is oftentimes an ECG will be obtained, partly because in adults, everybody with chest pain gets an ECG, but also in kids, you know, if your ECG is normal, then it's probably nothing. On ECG, you can have subtle findings of cardiac inflammation, such as ST elevation, diffuse ST elevation, other ST changes, low voltages, that all might suggest pericarditis. And so in the MISC protocol, ECG as well as BNP and troponin are some of the things on that sort of second tier workup for kids with that have MISC.
Now, given given your particular area of expertise, how is echocardiography helpful in evaluating an inflamed heart?
It's extremely helpful.
Good call, right?
Yes.
Excellent career choice.
So, you know, echo, you can hear valve regurg, but you might not necessarily know what is involved. And so echocardiography gives us a thorough look at all the essential components of the heart that might become inflamed. So on an echocardiogram, we can look at the valves and look at regurgitation. We can look for pericardial effusions. Obviously, we also look at the systolic function of both ventricles. We have also echocardiographic parameters of diastolic function. So the heart's just not a pump. It also has to relax to allow blood to get into the heart. And
that's
so
that's probably a message for all of us, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. We can also, there are also echocardiographic parameters of diastolic function as well that we can look at. And then obviously we look at the coronary arteries, particularly in things like MISC and Kawasaki disease due to the association with coronary artery dilation or aneurysms.
As I mentioned to your colleague, Adam Ware, I always hear things much better once somebody has had an echo. Everything sounds much more accurate once somebody has actually seen what's going on.
Yes.
To me, to the amateur. So let's talk a little bit about what the cardiac consequences are in MISC. What happens to the heart in MISC?
Yeah, so many things can happen to the heart, and some have MISC as leading to a pancarditis. So essentially anything can go wrong with the heart in MISC. So one of the most common things that we've been finding is shock presentation, and whether that's vasodilatory shock or cardiogenic shock, both have been described, and sometimes in the same patient, which is a little bit unusual than we're used to seeing, because usually with septic shock or toxic shock, people often have hyperdynamic systolic function. But with MISC, you can actually have warm shock with decreased cardiac systolic function.
Wait, so let's go back to that again, because okay. I think that's a really important point. So the shock that you see in MISC is both a failure of circulation and of the pump?
It can be, correct.
Interesting. Okay. It's,
you can also have just vasodilatory shock with preserved function, or you can have decreased function with not so bad blood pressures as well. So okay. In the setting of sort of low normal or mildly decreased function.
And so are you also saying that that it can cause inflammation in various parts of the heart?
Yes. So, you know, the shock we talked about, but also myocardial dysfunction. So kids often have decreased systolic function, and about 40 to 50% of kids with MISC in various publications have had decreased systolic function. As I mentioned, they can also have poor relaxation or diastolic function. Valvulitis has been described, particularly of the mitral valve, pericardial effusions, particularly small ones. And early on in particular, which I think kind of led to the concerns about, you know, Kawasaki disease and is this mimicking Kawasaki disease, were the initial reports of coronary artery involvement. So far, early on, there had been reports, especially from the UK, of kids having giant aneurysms and potentially even having normal coronaries in the hospital and then progressing to a giant aneurysm. But since then, a lot of the coronary artery involvement has been dilation or what we would call small aneurysms. So Z-scores, which are the normalizations of the coronary artery dimensions to a patient's size, have been 2.5 to 5. Normal is -2 to 2. Most of the time it's been mild dilation or small, what we would call aneurysms, that are often transient and often resolve, luckily, fairly quickly so far.
It's potentially premature to really talk about long-term consequences in a disease we've known about for a few months. Mm-hmm. But that sounds somewhat encouraging. What do we know about what happens with pump function, both pump function and relaxation function? Does that seem to get better?
Yeah, so in reports that we've had thus far, luckily the majority of kids have normalization of their systolic function, oftentimes prior to hospital discharge. But typically definitely within a couple of weeks, but most of them even within the hospital. That being said, diastolic dysfunction has been found to persist in one recent study that was published that looked at echocardiographic parameters of diastolic dysfunction. And even when systolic function resolved, there were still components of diastolic function within a week of discharge. A lot of it overtly resolves, but I think we're going to need to know longer term what the longer term effects are.
Yeah, these are kids who are probably going to need long term follow up, and as we've already seen in the few months we've been tracking this disease, it's a shapeshifter, and so it's probably important for us to keep an open mind.
Yes, and we're learning more every day.
Yeah. So beyond that, in your experience as a cardiologist, anything that you think that you'd like to tell a generalist about what you wish we wouldn't miss about inflammation?
I think the cardiac involvement is something that I think is concerning to everybody in terms of the potential long-term implications of that. I think, as Dr. Tremarki had noted last week, a lot of things have overlap of symptoms with MISC. And so while I think it's important to have a high index of suspicion, especially in the febrile child with symptoms, GI symptoms, mucocutaneous changes, and evidence of inflammation, I think we still need to keep in mind that other things can lead to that presentation, including cardiac inflammation. So other viral myocarditis, mm-hmm. Again, rheumatic heart disease, et cetera. So I think we need to continue to work things up appropriately with a broad differential.
Right, and keep an open mind. Well, thank you very much. We'll talk a little bit more next week in terms of tying this all together, but I really appreciate the foundation for our ongoing discussion. Thanks for your time and expertise. For those of you who have questions, please send your questions to questions@bcurb.com, and we'll address those in 2 weeks. Dr. Tran, thank you very much. See you next
thank
week.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.